You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Colombia.
It's that time of the week again, folks. It's me, your host, Richard McCall, here in Bogota, Colombia, 2,600 meters closer to the stars. And while it's an overcast day, it's not raining. And so I'm in my garden. You can hear the birds chirping in the background. So one of those great Bogota days up here on the mountainside. But today, in episode 222 of Colombia Calling, we're taking a different tact. Well, every week we take a different tact. And before I plunge into that, let's just ask, well, I thank you for all of the very positive feedback for last week's episode 221, where I read out the first chapter of my book, The Mompos Project. I think I'm closing in on an editor, so thank you, all of you out there who've helped me. And if you haven't read it, the link's on my website, that's richardmccall.com, and of course on Medium, that sort of platform for storytelling. Anyway, yeah, enough about me. We've got Frank Cardona on the line from Medellin, where he's currently working for Columbia Reports. Most of you who are Columbia files will know Columbia Reports because it's the most viewed website on all Columbia news, run by Adrian Aselma as well, who's been on this show. And we've had others, other graduates of Columbia Reports on this show, such as Stephen Cohen, in fact, who's been writing for The Republic, The New Republic. So, you know, very, very high standards of journalism that come out of Columbia Reports. If you don't know it, check it out. But Frank Cardona is there, and he's cutting his teeth as a young journalist. And, well, we got him on the show, this episode 222, because he's actually, you know, Venezuelan-born, as you can tell by his name, Frank Cardona. But he was raised in Canada, in Vancouver, so way out there on the West Coast. And he's back in this region, not only reporting on Colombia, but also telling the stories about Venezuela and Venezuelans now who have had to flee from Venezuela due to the issues that have been going on. And so let me just take this moment to say welcome on Columbia Calling, Frank.
Thanks for having me, Richard. Before we start, I wanted to tell you something. Last year I met you in Bogota, and you gave me the advice to stick to this niche, to start as a young reporter, so I wanted to thank you for that. It's kind of what I've followed the last year, and that's why I ended up at Columbia Reports. I thought it was a good opportunity to work on my journalistic experience and cover a situation that's close to me.
Well, fantastic. That's very kind of you to say so. But, you know, there's nothing like writing about something that has a personal, you know, impact, and it comes across in your writing. And the reason I got in touch is you have a blog very recently. You wrote a blog very recently, which was incredibly personal and showing the difference as, let's say, a Venezuelan who was raised abroad but feels Venezuelan, but seeing what your countrymen and your family are going through, and in particular, for example, your cousins in Bogota. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, originally I graduated from university in 2016, and I started talking to my cousin over Facebook. I hadn't seen him since 2002. That was the last time I was in Venezuela, and it's the only reason I can speak Spanish. Otherwise, I'd be a goner for that. But we started talking, and originally we were both going to go as tourists to Bogota. He wanted to go check out Colombia before deciding to move to Venezuela. But towards the end of 2016, the situation in Venezuela got pretty dire. He had a graphic design business, and he was getting robbed and extorted by gang members, police officers. And at one point he called me and said, "Primo, cousin, I've got to leave now. Like, I can't stand it anymore here." So we sort of changed up our trip. I arrived in January of 2017, and he arrived on the same day. So instead of arriving to La Candelaria in Bogota and going to a hostel and checking out Monserrate and stuff like that, on the first day, we're staying with family friends, and we end up getting kicked out of the place because we have nowhere else to go. And my cousin and his associate from his business have come to Colombia. And they got, they were worried that we couldn't find a place to go. But this is where you kind of see the different lifestyles. They're coming from Venezuela, dire situation. I'm coming from Vancouver, and I'm not worried. I could go on Airbnb in 2 minutes and have an apartment ready to go, and it wouldn't bother me that much. So at that point, I started to feel the differences in lifestyles of what I'm afforded to because my parents decided to migrate to Canada in the 90s. So instead of going around doing touristy things, I helped them find jobs, find an apartment, figure out how to travel across the city. And once they were stabilized, I started working for the Bogota Post as a contributor. I wrote 2 articles and then went around Colombia and got a similar experience. Everywhere I went throughout Colombia, I would run into Venezuelans working in hostels, restaurants, and I would talk to them. And I would get this weird sensation, or I would feel awkward because I would say I'm Venezuelan, but I'm not living the crisis. I'm not fleeing a country. I'm coming from Canada, one of the top 5 cities in the world, Vancouver, to live. So you kind of see this duality between my life. And then I came back this year and went up from Ecuador to Colombia. Same thing, tons of Venezuelans struggling in Ecuador. A lot of them get abused by employers. They don't get paid. They tell them to fuck off after they've worked for a little bit. And I helped another friend who was protesting in Ecuador. I mean, sorry, not Ecuador, in Venezuela during the protest last year. And his mom calls my mom, their childhood friends, and she says, my son's in danger. The Venezuelan police are after him for protesting on the streets in the hometown where I grew up, actually, too, in Maracay. It's like an hour from Caracas. And my mom bought him a ticket out of the country because his mom was crying and feared for her son's life. And that's who I met in Ecuador. And then I made my way back up to Colombia and found an opportunity with Columbia Reports to keep covering the story of migrants.
Yeah. Well, you're going to end up being an expert. Hey, you're going to be an expert. I mean, it's one of the greatest untold, like, forced migrations that's going on. I mean, we hear stories in the mainstream press. There are very illustrative stories about what's going on in Cucuta and other border cities here in Colombia, you know, women having to prostitute themselves and or sell their hair in parks. But this is only a fraction of what's going on, of course. What we saw earlier last year, the big protests, we saw only the cities. We don't know what's going on at all in the countryside. We don't know, for example, in your hometown of Maracay, really what's going on. I mean, can you fill us in, Frank, a little bit more of what's going on?
So inflation has killed the economy, killed people's personal finances. I'll give you an example. My aunt is a doctor in a hospital in Maracay, and she doesn't have enough money to feed her kids. If you're a doctor in Canada, you're making $100,000 you're living an amazing lifestyle. So we're talking about one of the richest countries in South America. Used to be considered the Dubai of South America, and now everything's disappeared, even middle class savings. It's gotten to the point that my mom, our family actually came to Medellin last month, all her brothers and sisters, and I've never been so surprised to see people so happy to eat bread, basic things that we take for granted out here, even in Colombia and Canada. And my mom sat them down and was like, I'm getting you guys out of the country. Luckily, our family has access to Spanish passports, so they're working on that process of going to go to the Canary Islands this year. So our family was never, we were a middle class family, never rich, never poor, but it's all evaporated. For example, an apartment my mom sold for a couple $1,000 10 years ago is now worth less than $100.
$100.
Exactly, like 17 million bolivares. That won't even buy a family a full basket of food for the month now.
So
it's.
I mean,
I also read this morning that inflation this year is going to hit 13,000%. Like. That's unheard of.
Yeah, I think we read the same article. It was probably about the Petro, the Bitcoin thing.
Exactly.
That, yeah.
It was on your
Yeah, well, because I couldn't not read it because this has confused me so much. I don't fully understand Bitcoin. I understand, you know, the concept behind it, but there are things, I'm not an economist, there are things that obviously escape me. But at the same time, so I'm looking at this Petro and I think, okay, so hang on. They're saying that each Petro is going to be pegged to one barrel of oil, but these are barrels of oil that are yet to be exploited and yet to be tapped into in beneath the Orinoco. So therefore, how can you speculate on financially in that circumstance? And the article was excellent because it says it will probably tumble Bitcoin. I mean, that's the truth.
Cryptocurrencies.
Yeah. I mean,
how are you supposed to trust such a corrupt government that's ranked in the low hundreds? I think they're like in the bottom 20 of corrupt countries in the world.
I think it's the bottom five.
Bottom five.
Yeah. But so Frank, I mean, you know, this is hard, obviously, for you, but wonderful that your family has the opportunity, and of course that your extended family has the opportunity to help other friends and so on get out of Venezuela. Others obviously don't have these opportunities. I read a statistic this week as well, as 4 out of every 10 Venezuelans still in Venezuela are planning to leave. I mean, 40% of who is remaining is trying to leave. We're already talking about millions who've left. I guess if you're governing a country this badly, and running it into the ground, if the only people who remain are your followers, what does that leave you?
Seems like Cuba 2.0. I don't know. People tell me people in Cuba are happy, but right now people in Venezuela are not happy.
No.
I can tell you that.
No, I have various Venezuelan friends here in Colombia. They've been here a long time, you know, 12 years and so on. And they've been watching it, of course, closely because they've got friends and family. And I always say to them, you know, Venezuelans, I'm not Colombian, but we should open our arms to every single one who needs to come across, like the hundreds of thousands of Colombians who went over in the 80s and 90s in the really bad era when there was so much forced displacement. Of course, the displacement continues, but they're not going to Venezuela anymore. But, you know, that Venezuela took them in and they got work. And that's why I'm saying all of these young Venezuelans who are of, let's say, Colombian descent, I mean, you can see them all coming back, but anyone else should come over. I mean, as a Latin American country, we need to take them in. I mean, you've got to open your arms to your sister nation, and that's the truth of it. But it's shocking what's going on, and you've told us a little bit about how you've seen it and how you're reacting to it. And of course, I mean, your experience coming down to Colombia and not being a traveler, but being basically a facilitator for your Venezuelan cousin. I mean, that's quite a rude awakening for a young guy. And you're thinking you're coming down on holiday and suddenly you're immersed in like the socio-political situation of North and South America.
Exactly. I feel awkward a lot. Just being raised in Vancouver. I'm not into salsa dancing. I'm not into salsa music. I'll tell people, hey, where are you from, man? They'll ask me that. And I'll be like, oh, I'm Venezuelan, but I grew up in Canada. I'm like a weird hybrid mix, bro. And it takes a toll on me, too, covering these stories.
Yeah.
Hearing stories from my family. My grandparents are unhappy. They're just watching their country disappear. And they're holding out. They don't want to leave the country. Both of my grandparents.
Yeah, well, you know, why would you? A lifetime there. Why would you want to uproot yourself in your later years? You can understand that. That's, you know, leaving everything behind. It must be so difficult.
I haven't been to Venezuela since 2002. From what I've read, I'm not even allowed into the country, because I no longer have any Venezuelan paperwork, a passport, an ID. And when I travel with a Canadian passport, it says I was born in Venezuela on the passport. So apparently if I try to go in through the border, they're not gonna let me in or out. And if I do get in, they might not let me out. I'll have to pay a bribe or
Oh, no, you'd absolutely have to pay a bribe. I think even legitimate people have to pay a bribe, so I think you're well within that bracket there.
That's true, actually. When my family crossed the border last month, they had to pay twice.
Twice? What, first to Venezuela, then to Colombia?
Not to Colombia. It was only on the Venezuelan side. But they didn't want to let my grandma out of the country because although she's been in Venezuela for 50 years, she still just has a Spanish passport. But they consider her a resident, so they didn't want to let her out, and they had to pay like 100,000 pesos, which is...
I know, but it's money. When you don't have any, it's money. And so, you know, it's different. Well, Frank, this has been incredibly revealing, and we're going to continue this conversation in the second segment of this episode 222 of Columbia Calling. Thank you so much for sharing these personal experiences. I know that people will be tuning in and will be amazed at what's going on, because it's aside from the, let's say, the, I don't want to say spectacular, but aside from the headlines that we see, we don't see anything else of what's coming out of Venezuela. And we're really, you know, those of us who are interested and are in the region, of course, we search, let's say, the specialist press to find information about this. But beyond that, there's not enough coverage. Maybe it's because journalists can't get in anymore, because I've also known of some journalists have been kicked out. So, you know, it's one of those stories. But we're going to take a short break, and we'll be back talking with Frank Cardona, a journalist who's currently in Medellin, but he's telling us about the situation in Venezuela, obviously from his viewpoint as a natural-born Venezuelan, but having grown up in Canada, in Vancouver, Canada. So we'll take a short break. Thank you for listening. Please don't go away. And we're back. This is Columbia Calling, episode 222. And I've been talking to Frank Cardona in Medellin. He's, a natural-born Venezuelan, but has been grown up in Vancouver, Canada. And of course, we're talking about Venezuela because he's a young journalist writing for Columbia Reports, but he's been, exposed to the Venezuelan crisis and what's going on. And I mentioned in this first segment, I was drawn to the attention of a blog that he wrote, and of course I'll ask Frank to tell us the website so that people can look at it. Of course I'll put it up on the Facebook page, but it's an excellent blog about his reactions to being a Latino, no Latino type thing. I mean, that's the identity crisis now that I guess a lot of us live, but you know, I'm the Anglo here in Colombia, but still don't dance salsa, like Frank is saying, but he's the Latino who doesn't dance salsa and so on. But it's difficult. It's got to be difficult for Frank to be in neighboring Colombia and seeing what's going on in his home country and hearing about what his grandparents are suffering and hearing about what friends are suffering. And so, Frank, I've got an issue. We were talking about crossing the border. If you were to go to Venezuela, you don't have actual Venezuelan paperwork. I mean, let's say physically on you. I'm sure in a warehouse somewhere where all the bureaucracy and red tape is kept in Venezuela, there is a record of Frank Silva Cardona. But if you were to go over on your Canadian passport, which said born in Venezuela, you would have all sorts of trouble. And you know, your family had to pay bribes to get over recently. But my question really on this one is, I mean, do you feel an urge to go over there? Does your journalistic instincts, do you want to sort of sneak across the border to write some stories?
I've thought about it a lot. I even went to Cucuta last year to meet a half brother I had never met.
Wow.
And I really want to enter the country, but anytime I bring it up with my family, they scream at me. They say, no, are you crazy? It's on top of the food scarcity, it's become really dangerous. Venezuelans I've met, my family say that they don't dare drive after sunset because there's malandros, gang members all over the place who are robbing people. It kind of scares me, to be honest, as well. But I would love to go. It burns sometimes that I can't go, especially since I've had some friends who have entered and they're foreigners. A friend of mine recently went in for a month, and she told me a lot of crazy stuff as well.
Yeah, tell us about that.
She was sending me photos of her dinner. It'd be lettuce with sauce on it. And she'd be like, I can't find any food to eat. I can't exchange any money. Nobody has money. There's lines for an ATM to get out 100,000 bolivares, which is 50 cents now. And on her way out of the country, she got stripped naked to check if she had any dollars. Now she's back in Colombia, and she says she loved... she said Venezuelans treated her very well, and she said she loved the natural beauty the country has. It could be a Colombia 2.0 for tourism. Well, it could rival Colombia's nature, but not many people dare go into the country right now. I've met some people who've also gone into the Amazon side to go see on the Brazilian side to see Angel Falls and do some of the hikes in that area. But even people who went over that border, they said it was seemed like a humanitarian crisis right as you cross the border. So you have to be an adventurer with spirit and maybe guarantee that you can get out of the country, which I'm sure if I went in and out, I could bribe my way in and out. But apparently under Chavez, before he died, they passed a law that restricted Venezuelans to enter and leave the country with a foreign passport.
Yeah, I'm sure they did. I'm sure they brought everything in to try and restrict. And that expression, it burns that you can't go to your home country. I mean, I understand fully. Well, I don't. I've never been through that situation. But I mean, it's a very tangible expression that you're saying. And I mean, you know, I think the only way would be in the south, in the jungle areas, or in the plains areas, just across. But of course, that's not getting you into where you want to go. I mean, you want to be where the people are. I mean, that's the reality, isn't it? You want to be talking to the people and seeing family and checking up on them. Just across down there in Guainia, or in Vichalen or Valpez in Puerto Carreño is not going to help you, because you're going down to these areas. What I found very interesting is I have a couple of friends in the Colombian Navy who work the ports on those rivers, the river that borders along the Orinoco and stuff, and they say all we see on the other side are Chinese workers. Always see, sort of basically cutting down the trees, opening up mines and getting the stuff out of there. Because like we know, China bought much of Venezuela's debt. And I guess the payback is that they take all of the natural wealth from Venezuela. I guess that's part of the, it's one of these sinister games in the global puzzle that's taking place at the moment.
Exactly. I've heard most of the cars that are imported now to Venezuela are Chinese cars. So there's obviously a direct partnership going on there. And then we have the U.S., the other superpower, who's slapping sanctions on leaders who are connected to narco trafficking, stuff like that. And a lot of people obviously Maduro blames the empire for Venezuela's problems. And I'm sure there's a little bit of that, but... it's got to be more of an economic mismanagement on their part.
Well, yeah, I mean, okay, some of the economic sanctions, yes, definitely there's a trickle down, and it affects population in terms of the sanctions of medicines not getting in. But Venezuela is an incredibly wealthy country, and to have got to this stage of, let's say, visible poverty, suffering, and misery is incredible, mismanagement from a government level. Despite the blockades and what have you, it's really down to an imbecile in charge levying childish economic policies. I think my two-year-old would be more apt. But that said, let's go back to you a bit more. Now, I wanted to explore this a little bit. You were down in Ecuador, and your mother had helped a friend's son get out of Venezuela and get to Ecuador, but you said he was being exploited by the Ecuadorians. Tell us a little bit about that.
Exactly. When I arrived, he had been working building soccer fields, laying down turf and stuff like that. And he would have periodic work here and there. And when I arrived, he was waiting to get paid. It been over a month, so that he could use the $200 he was owed to try to make the 5-day journey to Chile. A lot of Venezuelans see Chile as the promised land right now because it has a decent economy. And on WhatsApp groups and Facebook groups, you hear that there's lots of jobs. But once you get to Chile, it's actually quite hard to enter the country. I believe they ask for migrants to have at least $500 in their pockets. And so when I got to Ecuador, he was staying with an Ecuadorian family who was nice enough to let him live there for 3 months for free. But at one point, that situation got sour. And as I was there staying in Airbnb, he got kicked out of the place. So his friend and he and his friend ended up coming to stay with me for a few days. They ended up getting paid, and I helped them with a little bit of money so they could make the journey to Chile. And they ended up making it. They almost weren't allowed to go into the country because they didn't have $500. So they had to lie and say that they were on their way to Argentina. And he messaged me recently and said he's doing okay now, but a lot of Venezuelans say they're luchando, they're fighting basically to survive, and that's what he's doing right now. He gets work on and off, and especially if you don't have a professional degree that is certified by the Venezuelan government, it's very hard to get middle-class income, and that's a big problem in Venezuela right now, too, actually. One, it takes months to get a passport to leave the country. And two, to get your documents certified, like a degree or whatever titles you have to go to Caracas. And apparently the waits are long. There's colectivos robbing people's degrees out of the offices and stuff like that. You see all these crazy stories.
Yeah.
And a lot of the time you'll hear people in Ecuador and Colombians say, Why don't Venezuelans plan their trips better? Why are they coming here illegally? And I got a good answer from a lady I interviewed recently. She said she couldn't wait the months it takes to get a passport. It was either wait for her children to starve to death in Venezuela or come to Colombia illegally and try to get some money going so that she could send money back and eventually bring her kids over. But when you're an illegal migrant, it's very hard to get a job. Very hard to get an apartment. So she's been here for 5 months and she told me it's been a struggle. She's hoping to bring her kids over at some point. And she told me she's trying not to lose hope in her situation, but the government in Colombia is not helping her.
No.
Venezuelans are starting to create communities, little colonies, but there's only so much they can do.
Yeah.
It's projected that in Colombia alone, there's going to be over 1 million Venezuelans by the end of 2018. Not already.
Yeah.
Imagine. The official statistic, I believe, is 650,000 right now.
In 2017,
it's probably over now.
I think it's probably over 1 million now. I really do. I think the statistics must be wrong, or at least with an addition of those traveling through on the way south. Talking about going south, your friend who's now in Chile, he's got a job.
Yes, he told me it's on and off. Sometimes his boss needs him, and sometimes to save money, he tells him that he doesn't need him for a few days, that he can do a job by himself. So another thing I wrote about in that blog was a viral video of a Venezuelan barber in Chile. And apparently he was in Chile for a few months and was working his way up to pay for a barbershop. And once he made his final payment, the Chileans who he bought the barbershop off, they kicked him out of the place, blocked it off, and basically told him to fuck off. And he's crying in the video saying, like, I worked so hard to pay for this place, but since he's in the country illegally, he has no rights. The Chileans, they took precedence from the actual Chileans who owned the place, theoretically. So they basically got robbed of a year's worth of labor and money. So it's not to say that people in foreign countries aren't helping Venezuelans, because I've met many Colombians who are sympathetic to the situation. They'll let Venezuelans live with them. They'll give them employment. But there is also a lot of abuse, because if you're an illegal migrant, you have no rights. You're not protected by government services, labor services. So the situation can get pretty difficult, though.
Absolutely. Now, well, yeah, I mean, that's a, it's a dreadful story, and I'm sure it's repeated over and over again. Just one example of you know, someone taking advantage of another one. But good to hear that your friend at least is working in Chile. You know, we've got, and we've got another sort of 10 minutes to chat here and so on. But I wanted to ask you, because, you know, I have to say, for years, I guess, was it Chavez got in like 1999, something like that, or was it, I think? And,
exactly.
And then he was, you know, he ran, and it was the oil boom, so he had the money to prop up his, you know, his regime, giving money or aid to Belarus, Iran, Nicaragua, Dominica, wherever else, let's say the axis of not friends of the US when Bush was in power. And it was all very, very kind of, it was all kind of amusing, let's say, on a certain level, because there was enough money to throw around. And then, you know, the bottom fell out of the gasoline market, and Venezuela's only industry didn't, you know, wasn't yielding enough to pay off these things, and there were debts with Russia and debts with whomever and debts with China and debts, you know, debts with people you don't want to have debts with, let's not say that. But and so we kept, well, the media and experts are particularly guilty of this as well, myself in conversation additionally, just kept predicting the fall of the Chavez regime almost since, you know, 2004. We kept saying, well, it can't last, it can't last. And of course, he was solidifying his support base, getting rid of opposition politicians, sort of, I don't know if I can say disappearing them, like in the Colombian sense, but more, get, you know, making their standpoint illegal and making it illegal to run against him. And then, of course, shoring up the support of the military by increasing the number of officers and their wage, of the only people who seem to eat, I think, are the army now. And of course, putting that guy Diosdado Cabello in charge, really, who I think is probably the one pulling the strings, because I don't think Maduro actually has the mental capacity to do so. But
yeah, it seems like a puppet.
Yeah, we keep saying that it's going to fall, but it never does. And so my instinct is that it's not going to fall. This regime won't fall because he's got the support of the military. Diosdado Cabello likes having the puppet, and they just, it just seems to, wow, this is my personal opinion, but you as a Venezuelan with contact with more Venezuelans, with the Venezuelan community talking to you and so on, what do you feel, or what have you heard is might happen for the future? Because I know there's elections in May, but what, I mean, Maduro is a sure thing to win unless he, I mean, is struck down by lightning, I think. How do you feel about this?
From what I've heard from Venezuelans, people have lost hope in the next 10, 20 years unless there's a regime change. Two popular leaders, Leopoldo Lopez and Henry Capriles, are not allowed to run against Maduro from pretty BS claims by the government that they incited violence during protests, even though they weren't directly involved in any violence.
Mm.
And yeah, basically people have lost hope. A lot of people have been holding out for the last 4 or 5 years, and even my family, who did not want to leave, is considering leaving at the end of the year. The elections seem like they're going to be a sham. Maduro's running against a bunch of other socialist leaders, and then one right now, I think he's a pastor or something. And people just don't see any hope. I don't know what else to say. Even I've heard some analysts say that even if there is a regime change and you get a conservative government in, the damage that's been done to Venezuela's economy, industries, from expropriating everything, it would take a decade for things to fix themselves, essentially.
Yeah, I think you're right on that one. I think there's been such profound damage affected on Venezuela that any, let's say, if an opposition party got in, the repair process would immediately make them unpopular, because they would have to be, you know, limiting spending here in a pretty difficult economic time as they put the country back together.
Exactly. there's still a lot of free universities, whatever healthcare that there is, because right now it's really poor. People don't have basic medicines and tools for doctors, but it's still all subsidized by the government. So if the conservative government came in and flipped things over, people who are chavistas, who are in the lower economic sector, or lower, what do you call it, level, anyways, people who are on the lower side of society, they would riot for losing these services. And I have a recommendation, actually. If people want to read about Chavez's Venezuela, there's a really good book by Rory Carroll. He's a reporter from The Guardian who is in Venezuela. And the book is called Comandante, and it talks about all of the Chavez years up to 2013. So I wrote about that on my blog as well. Originally, with Chavez, you get this feeling that he really did care about the people. He was really trying to help the poor people of Venezuela escape poverty, get an education, have medical services and whatnot. But you see through the accounts that Rory writes about that while Chavez loved to rail on against aristocrats and people who had been in power originally in Venezuela, the oligarchs, sorry, wrong word, a new oligarchy emerged, the boligarchs, who are socialists, who preached living a more meager, conservative life, living a flashy life, but in reality, they're living a Miami life. They're partying, they're buying boats, they're buying Hummers, the latest fashions, just being really vain about things. So there's an incongruency there. And now a lot of people with money have left Venezuela, a lot of the businesses. So yeah, I don't know, it's just all crashing down, and you can expect this mass exodus, the diaspora, to continue.
Yeah, I believe that. Rory Carroll's book is I've only read parts of it, and Rory Carroll is there's one bit, I don't know if he writes about it, he probably does in his book, when Chavez humiliated him at a press conference. It's online, it's one of those marvelous moments that shows you how good a manipulator Chavez really was. And he says, Carroll asks a question in this press conference, and Chavez says, the Guardian, from England, that empire, that, and it came off, and Rory Carroll says, well, actually, it's not important where I am from. And Chavez, he seizes upon that. He goes, to me, it's important where you're from. Of course it is. It comes to this. But then at the end, you know, after all of this, and when the press conference was over, and obviously the question that Carroll had asked was not answered, Chavez approached him and just sort of said, all right, well, thank you for attending here, as if it was like no hard feelings, you know, really showing that he was a master manipulator. He knew how to work his crowd. Didn't matter about the journalist. It didn't matter about the question. It was about appearing the way he needed to appear before his, well, of course, nationally televised and broadcast on the radio, all of these press conferences. That's what was most important. So fascinating, but I definitely need to pick up a copy of that book and read it, because I'm sure it reads incredibly well. Is there anything else you've read on Venezuela recently that you would recommend to our listeners, Frank?
Yes, there was actually an article in Reuters. Is that how you say it? They wrote an article about a reporter who followed Venezuelans from Caracas all the way down to Chile. And I forget the name of the article. It was some along the 5-day journey it takes to get to Chile. And you kind of got an inside look into the different stories. There were really poor people, and then there were business owners whose money had evaporated and they had to leave the country. And you see moms with their kids just all searching for hope of a new, better life in different countries throughout South America. So that's a really good article I would recommend reading.
Fantastic, Frank. Well, listen, thank you so much for sharing these insights and the information that you're privy to about the Venezuelan diaspora through South America, through Latin America. In truth, it's been really interesting, because you know, these stories, these human angle stories, you know, get out here and there, but not as much as they need to, because this refugee crisis that is taking place, and it is a crisis, and it will only increase, needs to be talked about more. And of course, you know, we've got Colombian elections, not only, you know, presidential elections in May, Venezuela has elections in May too. These are both will affect what's going on in both of these countries. Everything is connected. So I'd like to take the time to say thank you again, Frank. Tell us what your website is so that people can be directed there.
All right. This is my work that I'm working on right now on Columbia Reports.
Yeah. Okay. So we'll watch for Frank's work on Columbia Reports and, of course, on his personal blog. I will put that up on the Facebook page and tweet it out. But again, thank you to Frank, and obviously hope to speak to you again in happier circumstances somewhere down the line, when we can talk about maybe some positive something. If there's anything positive to say about Venezuela in the coming months, until when are you in Medellin, Frank?
Roughly until May, maybe longer. It depends on whether I want to go back to Canada or not.
Well, if you do go back to Canada, make sure it's summertime. That's all I can ever say. But anyway, so we're signing off for this episode 222 of Columbia Calling. We've been speaking to Frank Cardona, a natural-born Venezuelan, but brought up in Vancouver, Canada, but to giving us a really profound and personal insight into the reality of the Venezuelan diaspora, obviously escaping the clutches of this regime in Venezuela under Maduro and Diosdado Cabello. Take this moment to say thank you again, Frank, and all the best in your reporting there for Columbia Reports. Keep the reports coming, keep the blogs coming, because we'll keep reading them. This has been Columbia Calling. I've been Richard McColl. Thank you for listening this week. Bye-bye.
Ever tried reading while jogging, cooking, or even juggling flaming torches? Yeah, doesn't end well. But with audiobooks.com, you can conquer books without the circus act. Dive into over 450,000 titles, including more than 10,000 free ones. Get hooked on a bestseller, find your next obsession, or finally read that classic you've been avoiding since high school. And here's the inside scoop. Sign up today for a free 30-day trial and snag your first three audiobooks on the house. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcastfree today. That's audiobooks.com/podcastfree.